So today, I got this mailer, political mailer. As people know, I'm registered at Working Families Party, and I live adjacent to within the bounds of the belly of the beast. People know that. So this is what I got today. Front of it, big blue field, white letters. Shouldn't you have a voice in choosing the next mayor? Question mark. On top, it says, safe neighborhoods, clean streets, proven leadership. The deadline is Friday, May 24th, 2024. So now I get it. Like, I'm not registered to vote in the primary, and I live in Wilmington, so, you know, look on the back. Who's pulling this? You, that's right, folks. John Carney's pulling this. So again, Jack Markell gets to live in a villa in Rome, and Carney has to pull out the Plan Prosicki and try to get people to, you know, get scared and change their registration to go vote in the primary. Found it very, very interesting, folks, and it's very, very sick. But things do come full circle, because this is the move that Prosicki used against Eugene, famously. And now Carney comes for his next demotion, and on his way down, he endorses Eugene, trying to go up. It's funny. Delaware is very funny. Well, we are in the shadow of Rockford Tower. We're behind enemy lines. We're in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is Rob. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. This is an important one tonight because I think people are very interested in this gubernatorial candidate. So we have Carl on the knobs as usual, and joining me in the studio is Colin O'Mara. So, hi, Colin.
Rob, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it was cool. We're basking in the glow of just watching your performance in the. Now, I don't know if that was a debate tonight or a sort of a forum, candidate forum, but it got a little saucy because Ramon was there. But otherwise, it was more of a just hit the bullet points kind of thing. Is that how you sort of felt about it?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the issues were more focused on, you know, the black community, Route 9, and kind of parts of the city that have not been part of the debate so far. And I do feel like I'm doing kind of the post-game, like CNN or MSNBC right now. It's kind of funny to come right after the debate and be with all of you.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I will tell you is Carl will not be holding up, like, 30-second signs. And there will be, you'll have plenty of time to, like, sort of jam a little bit. Yeah, you won't have to, you know, we won't have to worry about that. So you get the first question, which is something I think it's important. So I ask anybody sort of running or locally anyway, where you grew up, what it was like, and how it, if it did influence your sort of direction into public advocacy or public, you know, lobbying, public work, how did it?
Yeah, no, thanks, Rob. So I grew up in upstate New York in a household. My mom was a teacher and my dad was in the military. They met in college to both be teachers. They're at a SUNY Oswego, which is a kind of a teacher's university, a great kind of teaching program in upstate New York, even further north than Syracuse. After a few years of teaching together, it wasn't enough money to kind of begin to have a family. So my dad went to the military because the military paid better at the time than being a teacher, which is just kind of unbelievable. And so he was, you know, career force, and my mom was a teacher, took off a bunch of years. It was a pretty low income, middle income kind of community. A lot of folks that worked at the big factories that all closed during the 80s. My graduating class started with, I don't know, maybe close to 400 kids. We graduated with less than 300 because the kids either moving out or, you know, not either moving out of town or not finishing school. You know, kids had options of, you know, some went to school and some went to the military and some went to work. But I do think that, you know, growing up in a place that, you know, was more integrated, had, you know, limited economic opportunities at the time, and also some of the most kind of heart-wrenching pollution in the country. Onondaga Lake, which kind of Syracuse is nestled on, at the time was the most polluted lake in the country, kind of 100 years, 150 years of just dumping every kind of chemical and kind of steel product you can think of into the river, into the lake, kind of really got me thinking about how to, you know, create opportunity and, you know, think about things like environmental injustice. You know, we kind of used different language at the time, but, you know, we had some of the highest rates of cancer, we had some of the highest rates of different illnesses. And so that was the kind of the world I operated in, you know, kind of growing up. And so, you know, between that and, you know, playing sports with all kinds of folks, it kind of shaped who I am.
How'd you make your way to Delaware to begin with?
So it's kind of a tortured path. So I went away to school in New Hampshire. I went back to Syracuse to try to help the new administration that was trying to be more progressive, try to fix a bunch of things. Then went to grad school after that, and then wound up in San Jose, California, where I was working for the mayor of doing his, we called it the Green Vision, but it was his kind of economic development and environmental justice, environmental platform. And I worked for a mayor that didn't really like to travel. And so he kept sending me to kind of different places to represent the city. And in one of those places, some folks that were part of the Governor Markell's campaign saw me speak just kind of randomly. And so I get a call 6 months later asking if I had any interest in potentially being in their cabinet. If they asked everyone else who wanted Denmark and no one else did. So that was kind of the default. You know, so I was a wide-eyed 29-year-old when I came here, you know, 15 years ago.
You're like, I'll give it a whirl. Fair enough. Fair enough. So let's get into it. I am really interested in some of the details and some of the things that you think you can do in the context that we're working in now, which I think you do understand pretty well just based on your time in Denrec. But I think before we get there, we got to talk about what you have done first. I'm a rank and file WFP member. I was surprised about the endorsement. I'm skeptical of it. I'm open to it, but I think one of the reasons I was surprised is that there's a portfolio of work that I think is, needs to be reckoned with, I guess we will say. And not just because of the individual things, but because of the project that it was advancing, I think is pretty clear to me. So let's get into it. Fisker, I grew up over there. I actually grew up on Boxwood Road by the old GM plant. So the Fisker collapse was a little bit, it hurt me a little bit because I grew up, that's where they made all the Chevettes. Now it is a Amazon warehouse. I'm going to talk about that too. They didn't get to a question tonight about warehouses, but we'll talk about that. Bloom Energy, which I know you went out and visited and with the Dido people and Markell and sort of put that together. And I even look at, like, some of the stuff around the refinery in Delaware City, like them, just sort of, like, trying to make it easy for them to do this new business. I find it all very suspect as I'm a leftist. I don't use the word progressive, but I find it very suspect. And one of the things that you said during one of these, I guess it was the Bloom. And I wonder what you think of it now. Is natural gas a way forward? I mean, is it a renewable fuel? I mean, that was the argument, right? Is that this was a sort of a stepping stone forward? And I think the state or you specifically had to call it a renewable energy. I mean, the portfolio look. How do you reckon with the portfolio, and how do you explain that to people who are skeptical of it?
No, obviously, renewable energy does not include natural gas. Does not include any fossil fuels.
You did say that, though.
No. Actually, I never said that. What I said was that many other states had allowed fuel cells into their portfolios, regardless of the fuel coming into them.
Okay.
And so California, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Maryland had already allowed fuel cell technology into their renewable portfolio standard. And the rationale was that we start with, the dirtier fuel, hopefully get to the cleaner fuels. Now, the problem is that they never came, right? So, like, the idea was to go to either hydrogen or go to, like, landfill gas, some kind of bio waste, and have them powered by that instead of natural gas. Just the market never emerged because we had gone into austerity during the Paul Ryan years, and then now we're finally getting to a place where we can talk about hydrogen and kind of non-natural gas, kind of biomethane coming from landfills and things like that. But like if I could do it differently, I would have 100% insisted on landfill gas at the time. But Robin, I do think that if you think about the context we were operating in, let's go back to the end of 2008, beginning of 2009. We lose 25,000-30,000 jobs fairly quickly. We lost the two auto plants within 12 months of each other. The refinery goes down. pretty much all the places that folks who didn't have a college education could earn $60,000 were either already closed or on the brink of collapse. And so we were trying to figure out ways to rebuild that hole in the Delaware manufacturing economy. There's 50,000 manufacturing jobs, 49,000 manufacturing jobs in the state, you know, in the year 2000. Right now we got about 27,000 left, you know, and at that point it was actually even a little lower in the early 2010s. And so, you know, we were trying to find companies that could actually make things so they didn't become warehouses, so they didn't become, you know, big parking lots or big parking garages, or, you know, places that didn't have a lot of jobs. And like, I mean, I think, you know, hindsight's 2020, and, you know, the I have a lot of frustration and regrets about how some of the deals played out. But, you know, I am proud to say that there's almost 800 people still working there. We're kind of at the center of the hydrogen economy right now. And so, you know, I think we didn't envision some of the things that changed in the marketplace, and we probably should have. But, you know, overall, you know, I'm proud that there's a lot of people working in Delaware. You know, there's, you know, more than 1,000 union folks working at the refinery that wouldn't have those jobs if we hadn't figured out a way to restart it. And, you know, we were able to reduce pollution by 40%. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, there's obviously consequences from having it operate at all. And so, you know, I think, you know, I want to create more union jobs. I'd like to see them in the clean energy economy to the extent possible. But I do think that, you know, we've learned a lot in the last 15 years, as, you know, as we've realized we have to diversify our economy in a cleaner way.
Well, let me jump off of that a little bit, because I think my issue with it, like I said, and I read a little bit about sort of a lot of this stuff, and I don't think it's worth picking apart so much each detail, because the fact of the matter is that regardless of sort of the economy that we were living under, the Markell administration, and Delaware in a whole, hasn't changed. It's actually gotten worse. Prioritizes this idea that we got to fill this jobs gap. Like this is the one thing we do is figure out how we can get these companies to come in here. We subsidize it. We give them incentives, and we're going to get some sort of jobs. At least in the case of Bloom, there were benchmarks. I don't think Fisker even had any. But the idea that that's, you know, we're always told that the economy and the market economy runs, it's like a natural thing, like it's supposed to just do what it does. Now, I don't agree. I don't agree with it. I think we engineer it, and we're engineering it worse. I don't know whether this needs to be a priority, right? And that's the issue that I have with it. Now, I also understand, and that's just what I told everybody last week and what I told Carl. I mean, I made a living doing something. You know, you're working in the Jack Markell administration. I know that I understand that they have a certain agenda, say. However, you know, the whole idea that there was a DDO, or there is sort of an organization at the highest levels of the executive branch in the state that decides how they're going to interject themselves into corporate matters, I think is ridiculous for people who think the way that I think and what we need to do. So that was my concern about it. And so, you know, I don't know. I know, you know, I know that's not going to change in any great fashion regardless. But when I'm looking for a progressive, like a movement person, I'm looking for somebody who's really going to take a hard look at that kind of priority. Like, should we be just incenting people? Like, I'll give you an example, but we'll talk about something that's happening now, so this is relevant. You've been following what happened at the port? So we got the port down here. We tried to sell it to give it away. That didn't work, so we figured maybe if we spent more money to try to give it away, that would work. You know, I looked at some costs, or I shouldn't say I looked at it. Carl Baker wrote about it, and I read about the costs that it would take to get Edgemore up to snuff. It's astronomical. We're already into them for, I don't even know how much, hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, that's the kind of stuff that's absurd to me, and that's happening now. So that's something as governor you would be in the middle of, in the mix. What's your position on sort of like what happened at the port? What's happening, and what you would do about it?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think let me take one step back, and then I'll get to the port specifically.
Sure.
I mean, like, I think one of the things I've learned over the last, you know, 15 years is that, you know, that if you don't have strong schools, if you don't invest in people, if you don't have like a trained workforce, if you don't invest in all the kind of the social network, kind of safety net, that you have to throw money at companies because you don't have an alternative. And so like this idea that we're ever going to chase other states that are going to be able to write a bigger check, it's just kind of lunacy. And I learned that, obviously over some mistakes, right? I mean, I think, we've learned a lot. But, I'd like to see, it's funny, Carl and I were in Dover, a month and a half ago, advocating for free school lunch. And everyone's like, oh my God, it's $30 million. We're going to free breakfast and school lunch. But if some company needs $30 million to, relocate here or to expand here, all of a sudden that money's available, right? And like, and I think in the port, I understand like there's a ton of union jobs at the port, and I get that. I mean, I think that getting the pollution pieces of like Edgemoor right and making sure that the communities aren't facing the kind of fence line, pollution they've suffered from for too long is going to be really important. I also think that we have to figure out ways if we want to compete and retain any of those jobs. Now, I think the way it was sold originally was going to be private investment. It wasn't going to need the public investment. And then it kind of evolves, right? And then all of a sudden now we're looking at $190 million in the bond bill that again was kind of set aside in a sheet account that was kind of walled off from the General Assembly to spend for other purposes. And now it's being, and that's only 30% of the project cost. I mean, the project cost is more than $600 million.
Yeah, I know it was around $200 million, and then it's a third of it or something.
So I think the question is, what guarantees do we have if the public plays that role, that the private investment is going to be there, that's going to stay a union facility, that we're not going to have a bunch of things automated, that we're going to have actually, jobs that are going to support people, and have some of the few union jobs of color that we have left in the state.
Yeah, and then my thing is that can be done, that is that's a natural resource of us. As Delawareans, we have a big port, and we can make a big complex out of it. Like, we don't have to pay out the nose to have somebody else do it. Like, I'm not in favor of not expanding it. I'm not in favor of all of the things that you said to ensure that, the stevedores and longshoremen can have, a stable job, and we can have more of them. I don't know why we pay... Why we have to pay different series of private industry to do that? We don't have to do that, actually. I don't think.
No, I agree with you, and I think I would rather there's been a lot of things privatized in the state over the years that should have been retained public. There's a lot of things that the state can make the direct investment instead of kind of giving it to a third party. And I'll give you an example on this one. There were conversations before this latest iteration of kind of ownership. To actually look at, more of the federal partnership with the Tigger and Tiger grants as a way to basically use state match for, an 80-20 split or a 60-40 split to have it be more publicly financed, which would then give more control to the state to make sure that you did have, prevailing wage and had project labor agreements and all the things that obviously we all support. So I support, right?
Well, there's democratic oversight.
That's right.
So we can ensure that at least we have a say in sending someone or electing officials that are going to make sure that all of those things happen. Otherwise, you don't have any democratic oversight.
Exactly.
And in 5 years, they can toss the fuck off.
Well, and this is my problem with the previous arrangement with the Qataris, right? Because the Emiratis, sorry.
Yes.
Because we had less and less of a share of the seats of the actual oversight. So you saw massive cost cutting. Of course you did, right? Because they were trying to figure out how to, maximize their margins at the expense of the maximize private gains, kind of minimize costs. And so, we saw massive, kind of uncertainty around a lot of jobs. And so I just think if we're going to have a public asset like this, we have to retain sufficient control to make sure all the public goods are actually realized and they don't get, the profits get, privatized and the costs get socialized.
Yeah, because really what we're doing is the idea that we're selling, like I said at the beginning, I look at it like this idea that Markell and Carney and Alan Levine and Saren Cade and all these people, this idea that jobs... is like that sort of creates what we need to create, but really what it does is just create profit for the people who are giving you the job. But we don't say that part. It's the easy thing to make your top priority because you're like, well, you have to work. That's how we kind of set it up. And we're going to spur these, we're going to pay this place to do business so you'll have a job. But it's not, you're paying them to just, I mean, I'm not going to say exploit labor because we're not going to get into Marxist shit here right now, but that's really what's happening, right? And so the idea that that's the priority, I think, is already – we're already down the wrong road on the first step. And I'm not saying that we're going to turn around immediately, but that's why I'm skeptical of the whole enterprise.
No, I agree with you, and I think my thinking's evolved because – it's much easier to help a company go from like 5 to 10 employees here that's already here than trying to attract somebody from another state when you're bidding war with 16 other states in a race to the bottom. And like that was the economic development model of 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I think it's evolving, right? I mean, because I think more and more, especially if folks can telework in different places, like making sure you have, you know, strong schools, you know, kind of safe streets, you know, kind of the basic, you know, kind of infrastructure that are kind of people centric. Yeah. It changes the economic calculation. Because my thing is I want folks to be here because the talent wants to be here, as opposed to some CEO that may not be have a job in 3 months, right, is making some decision because you gave them a big check. Like that's just, it's not enduring. And we've seen in some of these other cases where, you know, when the incentive runs out, they just move to the next place, right? They just kind of pick up and
yeah. There's lessons to be learned, and I'm happy to hear that you've sort of absorbed those lessons. So that's good. The thing about the other union point I wanted to make before we move on is that you know, there's a big boom in the warehouse. We're in a spot where like the warehouse is king, and so rather than thousands of UAW workers. At the end of my road there at Boxwood Road, there's, I don't know, a couple hundred or almost 1,000 Amazon workers not unionized. Not the greatest job delivering or working in an Amazon plant. We know that. That's been well documented. But it's a warehouse job. Fair enough. Now, what about unionizing them? What about calling the Amazon Labor Union and saying, as a labor department and as a governor, I'm going to call the union in because I think all of these people should be unionized and have union benefits because we paid for you to come here. These are all of our citizens working here, and we support unions. I mean, I think we have to think, when we talk about unions, we have to make sure we sort of include everybody or as many people as
like we I completely agree. Look, I mean, we're in a reality now where folks are making $30 to $40 an hour minimum at Boxwood Road, and now they're making $15 with no adjustments for, you know, nominal wages and real wages, right? I mean, like, it's actually, like, you know, 50% less, 60% less than folks were making before. You know, one of the things I run the National Wildlife Federation, obviously, here in my private capacity, but one of the roles I play is the co-chair of the Blue-Green Alliance nationally. And so we work closely with UAW as they're trying to, you know, kind of reorganize in a lot of places across the country, you know, and the steel workers and others. And you're seeing more and more movement in the South and kind of different regions. You know, we have one of the lowest union densities in the country right now of any blue state, you know, kind of self-proclaimed blue state. And so, I mean, I'd love to see a whole bunch of industries organized because I think there's a real opportunity to make sure that wages and benefits are not just enhanced, but actually, you know, kind of create those kind of living wages that folks can actually support their family. And so, you know, I'm absolutely in favor of, you know, kind of these union drives that we're seeing all over the place. I'd like to see a little bit more here. And I think, you know, one of the challenges with the local party is that we haven't been particularly supportive of, you know, community workforce agreements, project labor agreements on the construction side or on organizing drives on the company side. I mean, there's an opportunity to have a governor that can actually, you know, support workers by, you know, doing more than, you know, words, but actually showing up with action and trying to set conditions to unionize.
Yeah, no, I agree. I know that. I'll put it this way. I think when we talk about a governmental role, there's a role to play. One of the things that that Carl can beep this out because you'll be uncomfortable by this. But one of the things that Genocide Joe is good at is the labor thing. The NLRB is just stacked with attorneys and bureaucrats that are trying to support working people. They're not paying, you know, companies to maybe do speculative jobs. They're saying, no, the workers that you have, if they want to organize, we're going to be actually behind them. The government can do that. Like, they don't have to just use words, you know. They can step in and, you know, be on the side of labor. You know, if people, you know, joking aside, if people do want to try to convince people, maybe your parents in Pennsylvania, like my parents, you know, the Biden administration is good at labor issues, you know, for whatever that's worth at this point. But I do think there's a governmental role to play.
Yeah, no, like, I agree. And I think, like, I mean, having the president actually walk with UAW to kind of send the signal to the big three that they were serious, I mean, I think there are roles that the government can play. I think there's also some things on the procurement side, right? I mean, like, we talk a lot about the construction side. We don't talk as much about the procurement side, but, you know, making folks that, you know, making sure the money that we're spending in different, you know, different industries is supporting working folks that are actually paid a living wage and, you know, have union protections is a, you know, another policy we've seen other states have that have similar democratic makeup, but, you know, we're not even anywhere near that conversation yet.
So there's a couple more issues I just want to let you expound on a little bit, and then I kind of want to talk about, like, just in theory, what you think you can do in this sort of closed, very famously closed system here that we have. So one is police reform. I work in police reform in my day job. I was happy at the event tonight that you mentioned the effort to significantly reform Leo Boer last year failed. Unfortunately, something did pass, and so when that happens, as we know, that's it. Like, you got something. Doesn't really matter if you got a nickel or you got a dollar, you got it, and that's that. So that was a failure. There are some other sort of criminal justice related efforts in the legislature now that are not great, and some of them that were even struggling to do sort of narrow sort of changes because, and I think this was mentioned tonight, the police lobby is extremely integrated into the Delaware way. What were your thoughts about what happened with Leo Boer, since you mentioned it specifically at the event? And then in general, where do you think you are with some of that stuff? I know they're looking to abolish the death penalty. There's a lot of talk about how bail is going to work and who can be detained without hearing, without bail, or without or with high cash bail. Where are you at with some of this stuff?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, I think the Senate Leo Boer language bill last year, right, 2 years ago, now is one of those great case studies, or kind of horrible case studies of the Delaware way, right? You literally had a majority of the Senate on the bill, right? Like it got through committee, and then all of a sudden it pauses, right? Because all of a sudden there's a kind of Delaware way pushback on the underlying bill. And then all of a sudden then that version's, deemed dead one day, and then all of a sudden you get, HB 205 and 206, whatever it was, as the very weak substitutes in eliminating what I would argue that is the most important part of, which is the civilian oversight and making sure that there was actual transparency and actual, citizen involvement. And so, and then not even having the piece to allow local entities to create that. And so, like, I think, we're going to still continue to have trust issues with communities until there's more transparency. And we got to do two things simultaneously, right? We got to build the competencies and actually the skills of the actual law enforcement, and that's everything from cultural competencies to having their efforts in de-escalation and kind of all the skills that I think we're lacking right now. But I think there's also a question around like how we've criminalized poverty in a lot of different ways. Like, we're still sending cops out from mental health divisions. We haven't seen the same level of investment in kind of first responders that are actually mental health professionals and others that could actually de-escalate a lot of situations. So, I mean, we've created a situation where we've basically criminalized, just being in some cases. And that's why I do appreciate Sophie's work on the Homeless Bill of Rights, which is a start. But, we have a lot of folks that are, unduly in the system just for trying to exist. Then we've criminalized, kind of poverty again by having a bail system that prevents folks from being able to, get bail. We got probably 170 women in Baylor tonight. Because they can't afford a couple $1,000s for bail, for a lot of times for very minor, very, very minor infractions, and so I think there has to be a bigger conversation that connects the pieces, because I feel like we deal with them separately, right? So we got the constitutional amendments on bail reform right now. I'm worried about getting kind of caught up, but I think we gotta be vigilant there. But I like the idea of only reserving bail for, I don't think it should be a money question. I don't think there should be cash bail. I think you should either you get, you get released or you don't, but like you it's not based on your ability to write a check. I just think it sets up every perverse incentive you can possibly have. I think that there's, and I think that the new versions of Senator Townsend's legislation with Representative Bonbeck, I think get closer. I'd be curious on what you think about that. But, it was just introduced, I think today or yesterday, kind of the updated version.
Yeah, I haven't seen an updated version.
Yeah, so I'd be curious. I mean, it's worth talking about. I think
I'll see it tomorrow. I'm actually going to go down there tomorrow because it's a lobbying day for the death penalty abolition measures. It's one law and then one constitutional amendment. And so I'll just be poking around down there. By the time this goes out, I'll have already been down there. So nobody, because when I show up there, everybody gets like, does one of these numbers. So it's fun. Yeah. So I just pretend like something's going to happen. It doesn't happen. Sometimes stuff does happen. But I don't know anything about it, though. So,
and the other two you raised, I mean, I do support Senator Pinckney's efforts to reform parole. I mean, I think there's big opportunities there. I think she's obviously taking a very kind of thoughtful, progressive approach to that. And then the death penalty is long overdue. I mean, we're way behind other places. And so, you know, I think there's a making of a package there. I think what I'm not seeing is the investment side to kind of reduce the pipeline into the criminal justice system and making sure that we're actually addressing the determinants that, you know, whether it's in schools or on the streets that are, you know, leading to more and more crimes of desperation.
Yeah, I think you're certainly right about the police sort of one of their top priorities. It's not articulated this way, but I think everybody, if you pay attention, you see what it is. They're sort of there to keep people where they're supposed to be, whether that's in certain neighborhoods, in certain places, even on the street. You know, we see that happening. That's their role. I actually just interviewed an academic from Arizona, University of Arizona, who wrote a book about police training. She was able to get access and do a bunch of academies, basically. And it's the police are trained well for the outcomes that we get. I mean, that's why the reason that we get violent outcomes is because that's what we tell them to do. And so, you know, I don't know. There's a whole chapter on de-escalation since you mentioned it. It's funny, but it's dark. and so the only way to start combating this idea that they're this insular sort of protector against the hordes at the gate idea is transparency. That's the only thing, and I know that that's going to be the most difficult thing. This is why the police fight that the hardest, because I think that they know that. I'll give you an example. This session, one of the things that the Office of Defense Services wanted to do was file a bill that would allow criminal defense attorneys to get police misconduct records at criminal trial under the rules of evidence, supervised by the trial judge, not public, you know, just the same way sort of like autopsy photos aren't public like that. Because in Delaware, now civil attorneys, when they have a civil suit against a officer or a police force, they get those records in civil cases. Criminal don't get them. So we pitch it like, hey, we didn't get anything last year. And this is sort of like an institutional change. You don't have to make anything public. You don't even have to deal with the public. This is just in the criminal justice system. Let's just make it fair, both sides. In the criminal trial, rules of evidence, let's go. It's not going anywhere. It's just dead. Now, why do you think? I mean, I shouldn't even make a question like that. I mean, you know why it is. Because police understand that any transparency into what they're up to is a threat to what they think they need to do. And until we break that spell about their lives being in danger every day, now police do get hurt sometimes. That's true. But when you talk to a truck driver or a commercial fisherman or a roofer or somebody who works on an oil rig or you know, whatever, you don't, the part of what they tell you when they tell you about their job isn't how dangerous it is when it's extremely dangerous. And so, you know, until we break that spell, I think we're going to have a difficult time in addressing any of this because they're going to fight it tooth and nail because they like it the way it is.
Well, and it's interesting too, because I've had lots of conversations with, you know, different types of law enforcement over the last, you know, few years, right? And like, you know, 95% are just trying to do their job, right? And I think there's this fear that it's not going to just kind of uncover like the bad actors and, you know, kind of this idea of, you know, looking back at incidents that go wrong, but at some point they'll get caught. And so there's like this weird, I mean, it's like this kind of dystopian, right? Kind of like fear that's like there, where, you know, the place that we've seen body cameras and other devices, I mean, it hasn't led to, right? I mean, in any case, if we've seen the transparency have an advantageous impact because, you know, you have fewer shootings, right? You have fewer, you know, fewer things that escalate because all, you know, all of a sudden there's, you know, greater transparency. So, you know, and this is another example, though, you know, of, We've got supermajority in the Senate, almost supermajority in the House. We only needed 50% for these bills, right? And the fact that they can't move, well, Maryland's moving them, Jersey's moving them, New York's moving them. I mean, even Pennsylvania's moved some of it. Like, it's just a failure, just appeared, right?
Rhode Island just repealed their Leobor a month ago, maybe. Yeah.
You know, and so it's states that have a fraction of the majorities we have, right, that are, you know, moving these things. Again, it just shows that you just need leadership, right? It comes back to having governors that are willing to lean in and then legislative leaders that are
perfect. That's a perfect segue to like the final part.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you must have read my mind. I know I keep my notes hidden, so I know you didn't read them. Maybe Carl's leaking shit. I don't know. Who knows? It is funny that you said lean in. I know you said that in a certain context, and I understood what you said, but Bethany said that, like, I think I counted eight times. Eight times, and like...
Yeah, Sheryl Sandberg's just cutting royalties at this point, right?
Cha-ching. One of the critiques I've always had, you know, not the joking ones, but the real ones of Governor Carney, has been that he doesn't really have an agenda. It's like, well, we carve this out of the budget and we carve that out. And we said to do this thing and they did it. They put the sign up or they did the highway thing or whatever. And there was no real forward-looking, optimistic call to action agenda. It was like, I compare listening to his State of the State address usually to like listening to, the CFO tell you why like 90 of your colleagues just got fired. It's like that. And so nobody's looking to do anything. And I think that you're different in that. I look at what happened in Minnesota over the past couple of years with a Democratic progressive legislature and governor. And it's very exciting. So, yeah, what is your agenda? But more importantly, how do you think the executive of Delaware can accomplish an optimistic, aggressive, progressive agenda?
Yeah, no, I first really appreciate the question. And, like, watching what happened in Minnesota, what happened in Michigan, what even happened in, like, you know, Pennsylvania having one chamber for a little bit, right? I mean, it just changes it's interesting. These places that haven't had Democratic control are so much less complacent than we've become. Like, I think our problems all really start with the way that the budgeting control is entirely vested on the executive branch, right? Because when you propose the budget and then use the fiscal note as a reason to kill everything from every point and from that point forward, or you allow those decisions to be made only by a couple people, you basically de-democratize, lowercase d, the entire legislative process. And so, you know, I think it starts with the budget, right? Because, I mean, imagine, you know, going into 2025, if free school lunch was built into the budget, if, you know, additional resources for affordable housing was built into the budget, if, you know, pay raises for educators and, you know, a bunch of things around universal pre-K were actually baked in from the beginning. So then it's a question about how you implement them, not if you implement them. You change the entire dynamic in Leg Hall, because at that point, somebody's got to physically take it out of the budget in the JFC process. And, you know, and Carl and I have talked about this before with Cheyenne on the, you know, on the other side. They basically set up a system, right, where you have to beg for permission. So the legislature is not a co-equal branch at all. And so if you actually have a governor that's willing to say, like, look, like, we don't have to, we're going to get it to the floor. We're going to actually have a transparent vote on it. We're not going to have these things kind of bottled up in desk drawers forever. And the money's going to be there in the budget. That changes the landscape for everything we've talked about today. Right. So, I mean, I do think education first and foremost. I mean, we're underfunding schools by $600 million to $1.1 billion. It's a completely inequitable formula that's been the same one for, you know, since the 1940s. Like, if we get that one piece right out of the gate with additional revenue and then actually can direct it into schools that have multilingual learners, kids experiencing poverty, kids with special needs, like, it's a game changer, right? Because then you can have the conversations about, you know, making sure that the wraparound services are real, making sure that, you know, it's not just kind of mental health pieces, but kind of the full range of additional services for nutrition and, you know, dental. I mean, the kind of the full suite of needs. You can have the conversation about teaching ratios. I mean, right now, if I'm teaching AI, the high school, I got 25 kids in AP English, I got one teacher. If I got 25 kids that are struggling with the kind of, you know, remedial math, I got one teacher. And so, like, the ratios aren't calibrated at all to the number of students. Like, if we have a bigger pot for investment, all of a sudden you can have all those conversations. Because, like, I'm convinced after 32 years of, I mean, actually going back, you know, the 16 years before that, the reforms of Delaware on the education side have just decimated our public schools, right? So, I mean, I go back to the drawing of the lines for desegregation. 1978 with the order, 1981, when all of a sudden you have the four district solution, no additional money. If anything, they cut money because all the kids, you know, a bunch of kids from middle income and upper income families went to the private schools. Then we decided that choice is the answer to everything. So we're going to have a busing. Sorry, for folks that don't need busing, that don't need any kind of transportation. So again, middle class folks that have the opportunity to go to other schools that have transportation, all of a sudden, you know, pull out of the school. So again, the kids that can't get out are still in some of the lower income schools. Then we put charter schools on top of it, which in some cases we had entrance exams with assessments to determine who can get in. Other places we had geographic boundaries to, you know, keep those kids out from Wilmington. So, you know, all of a sudden we have yet another system that keeps kids experiencing poverty in kind of higher and higher concentrations. Then we kind of have testing regimes on top of that because somehow it's the teacher's fault, even though there's no additional resources, you know, and to actually help the students actually perform. Now, we've begun the last couple of years, right, to talk about, you know, mental health services, and there's, you know, the bill we passed a couple of years ago, the HB 100. We got another bill this year for the high school kids. But, like, we're only beginning to have that conversation in, I would argue, like, the 31st, 32nd year of Democratic control of the entire, of unified Democratic control of the entire state. So, you know, I think education first and foremost. I mean, the first state of the state, that first year, if you don't figure out education funding to make it more equitable and set us up on a trajectory, it's going to be almost impossible in the second year because no one's going to raise taxes in election year. Then you're in the third year, which makes it even harder. So for me, like, that's, like, the first piece. But what I'd like to do is work with all of you to make sure that, like, that first budget is not the last Carney budget, but is the first O'Mara budget that has all of our priorities baked in at the beginning. It's going to mean some tough cuts. Other places are going to need some additional revenues in a bunch of places. But we've been more or less operating on the same operating budget going back to the DuPont administration, just tacking on things year after year without actually reevaluating how we're spending a lot of money.
Yeah, your kids go to public school?
Yes. Yep.
Whereabouts?
We live in Apo, so we're in the Apo school.
Okay.
They're on 896, nice. Over by Lums Pond.
Because my issue always is, I don't have kids, but I agree with everything you're saying, and I feel like I have a vested interest in it just because I'm here. And the first thing I think you said was the perfect one is our income tax is the same whether you make $61,000 for every dollar, you know, for that dollar over 60, or if you make $460,000, the you know, what you pay is the same. It's not right. And what people are doing, wealthy people, are taking that tax subsidy and sending their kids to Tower Hill and Tatnall and Friends, et cetera. And so I don't. That's one way around it. The choice was the next thing that didn't work, which I agree with, you know, everything you said. I think they're a little bit better in Delaware than in some other places, but they're still awful for the reasons that you said, and you can go back to some of my conversations with school choice people on here and look at that. But yeah, I don't see a way around basically telling people, you know, you got to pay the big tuitions. My thing was, I think there should be, don't even worry about the income tax. Put a tax on people's private school tuition. Give them $7,500 for free. Anything over 10 grand, you pay, you know, 0.5%. It's not fair to regular kids. So yeah, I'm very happy that's something that you're going to tackle because again, that's the priority stuff like that. Real things that everybody gets. You know, there's no cost. Your kids just walk into school. They give them a book. Now again, if the teacher ratio is bad, or if there's lead in the water at the water fountains or whatever, that you know, that's awful. But it's a right that every kid gets to go do for free.
Well, look, and I think, you know, we've been kind of beating on the free breakfast and school lunch piece because, yeah, you know, you got the kids are on the bus for an hour, right? Because they're going from, you know, Wilmington to Glasgow or Newark, right, for yeah, school. I mean, we need to get Christine the hell out of the city anyway, but, yeah, yeah, that's coming.
Well, that's, yeah, well, that looks
it's been
like
coming
it's
for
coming
a long time, but it's, well, I think it's real this time.
It seems a little more, like, real than it has been. Yeah. They've made a little more progress anyway. Yeah.
And Tizzy and Namdi have been working hard on that piece, you know, with Jay Street and everyone. But I think, you know, but so then we set up a situation where, right, where they're hungry, they're, you know, cranky by 10, 11 o'clock, they're shocked that they're not, like, listening to, you know, civic history or whatever class they're in at that point. Then some kids act out because they're hungry. Then all of a sudden they get a disciplinary record. Then all of a sudden they're in the pipeline, right? It's just like, and it was one of these things, though, where you would have thought it would have cost $500 million a year for the level of opposition we got from the fiscal hawks in the Democratic caucus saying, oh my God, we cannot afford this, or people can afford their own thing. We got to, do this and that. And just, we're going to see that fight over and over again unless we change the way we budget, right? And this is, rehab versus, versus incarceration. This is investing in kids rather than, some of the, kind of school to pipeline kind of crises that we have. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of things. We're still operating in the old, 1950s, 1960s, kind of form of budgeting where you pay for the consequences and you don't actually invest in the thing that would reduce, the bad outcomes and actually lead to better outcomes.
Yeah, because you don't have a vision of a creative vision. I mean, that's what it is. If you did, you wouldn't, or, like you said, if you're just doing the same thing over and over and over again, you really don't have a way to go. That's why you always go back to the jobs thing. Well, we were trying to create jobs, I guess. I just don't, I don't think that that's, the idea that those economic people, whether they were Dado before and now something else, are the real sort of gatekeepers to all of this, with the police and, a few other sort of well-placed organizations. It's going to be, it's an uphill fucking battle, for real.
We got to break the cycle, because the thing too that folks I think haven't fully internalized in Delaware, if you don't break the cycle, that's when Republicans win, right? Because folks get so disillusioned with it. This is what we saw with Christie. This is what we saw with Youngkin. This is what we saw with Hogan. This is what we saw with Baker. Like, if Democrats don't deliver on kitchen table issues, I'd argue we're not on a bunch of fronts right now, then folks are like, screw it. We'll give the other side a chance, which is kind of hard to fathom in a state that's had 32 years of control. But we have the third longest stretch of Democratic control of any governorship in the country. The only two that are longer are Washington and Oregon. So, because in that same period, right, Schwarzenegger was governor of, of California. You had, Pataki, or, anyways, there's been other, different folks. Pataki was in New York. And so, you're in this environment where, we take it for granted right now. And this is also kind of frustrating on some of the constitutional amendments, right? Because, we're not enshrining things that, as a democratic state, we should have in our constitution, not just in our code. So if and when the, Republican Party does find a less MAGA, more, presentable face, we don't end up going back into the 1950s.
Yeah, it is interesting, because one of the things I talk about is we are sort of lucky here that, no offense to Mike Ramone. I know Mike Ramone. Yeah. I actually swam. He was my swim coach when I was 12 years old. Yeah, for real, at the Western Y. Yeah. And so, I knew him, sort of before, whatever you want to say. But yeah, there's no juggernaut. The reactionaries and the conservatives and the Republicans we have in Delaware all fit sort of particular categories, and they're not exactly, they're very niche. We'll say that, but that doesn't always have to be that way. Now, I don't think ISI is going to be pumping out a lot of real winners, but that doesn't, it could happen, especially when in less than another decade. We get another U.S. rep. How's that going to work? What is that going to be? It'll probably be a Republican rep.
Well, if you draw the line along the watersheds, so most of the Chesapeake watersheds in there, so you basically go from Newark at a diagonal down to Eastern Sussex, you carve out Eastern Sussex and you carve out Dover, all of a sudden, you get a district that's close, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that way, but, given our history of redistricting.
Yeah. And again, this just comes back to what I sort of said at the beginning. It's a matter of going in to a position with an idea, with a foundation of ideas that you're going to try to do. And it's not, it's not just moving numbers around and being like, well, if you carve out this, you can do this one thing.
This is the bottom line why I wanted to throw down with WFP, because I do think that agenda is there. We just need an executive branch to help implement it. Right. And if they pick up a couple more seats and all of a sudden we got, supermajority and all of a sudden, if you had the right pull from the governor's office where all of a sudden not everything is a fight, but you're actually working in unison.
Yeah.
We got the numbers to move mountains. We just have to have the kind of the stars align a little bit more. And I think, under Carl's leadership and, the WFP board and everything, I think we're getting there in the House. The Senate, obviously amazingly kind of elected a couple of progressives in some key races as well. Replacing some folks who used to like to take walks on tough votes. And we've kind of moved from the Dixiecrat wing of the Democratic Party to a more kind of center left to even progressive wing with a lot of members. But you still, there's still this battle. I mean, the fact that we all had to spend so many years on marijuana, right? When it should have just been science, so it wasn't a fight, so we could use that time and energy towards other progressive outcomes. It's just indicative of, you know, the change
we
need.
And even marijuana, is in classic Delaware fashion, is, you know, reversing to the front, to the starting line. You know, we have an ex-cop commissioner, as is our deal. That's how we do it. But it's not exactly a dynamic process that's happening. You know, what are we going to get it next year, I guess? While even Maryland, you know, has it before. So even that's the other thing, too, that I always, even the stuff that we do get, that people say, oh, we got it, and we worked so hard for 11 years, and we got it. And we did. Fair enough. But, you know, what did we get? I'm not saying it yet.
And Sussex County is trying to have this narrowly tailored as possible, right, for their county level ordinance. Like, the municipalities all get to have their own. So what we're going to have is hodgepodge.
It's only going to be in between municipalities. Exactly, so any, like, unincorporated strip mall, you know, you'll get it, I guess. And again, who's going to get the licenses? They did get some of that sort of equity, yeah, sort of into the four different categories of licensing. But I guess, again, it's still wait and see, because we still, in the year of our Lord 2024, still cannot open up a proper cannabis shop.
And I just think it's just a little too on the nose. And I serve Secretary Coop. I mean, you know, he's a friend, but to put a cop in charge of this initiative after the war on drugs that criminalized marijuana for a generation.
We have to do that. It just shows you who has the who holds the sort of a lot of the keys to this. Maybe not the public face, because not everybody knows the guy, but I know he was well known in government circles. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the guy. I dealt with that guy. Everybody knows that guy. I was a cop, right? Now, doesn't matter, you know. So last question. I'm happy somebody wants to throw down with WFP, because I think they've earned some respect. I know that, you know, that also earns them the ire of, you know, the establishment figures who feel threatened by this. However, when you say that, sometimes I think, like, well, let me just get to the bottom of it. When you were living in Maryland, your wife ran for a position in Maryland, right? What did she run for? She ran for governor of Maryland on a Democratic ticket. Okay, so, got it. So, When I hear that, it looks like you seeking it out and wanting to sort of latch onto it. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know if you've had that conversation with other. And I'm asking as a WFP sort of rank and file, just person who tries to like, you know, support the team. That's my concern. And I don't want to make it. I struggle asking the question because it sort of sounds like a Delaware way question, but I don't think it is. It's more of a movement question. Like, when did you decide you wanted to do this, and what was sort of your motivation to do it? To not only to run for governor, but to run for governor of Delaware after, you know, your wife was going to ran for governor, in Maryland, and also to sort of seek out the Working Families Party. Do you know what I mean? So when people are asking you that, what's your general, like, how do you articulate that?
Yeah, like I was incredibly fortunate to move to Delaware 15 years ago, right? And we had our place here, and, you know, my wife, 6 years into that, 7 years into that, and, you know, she was obviously very, very loyal to the Maryland that kind of welcomed her after fleeing the civil war in Sri Lanka, and her family moved there when she was 9 months old. You know, I didn't want her to give up her dreams, because I was, you know, I'd like it here and she likes it there. And, you know, and now that the entire family is here, but, you know, we were in a, you know, kind of a long distance, kind of complicated relationship for many years. But, you know, voted every time here. I mean, I got 357,000 miles on my Prius right now, driving back and forth, you know, because I had a lot of things I cared about here. And I'm working on environmental justice and, you know, working with a lot of local communities. Again, not flashy ways, not in, like, Instagram or, you know, Facebook kind of ways, but just kind of doing the work on the ground. Like, I think when I decided about a year ago to look seriously at it, because I was just afraid of the same old, same old. You know, so Alana had just gone through school. She had her kindergarten year at in Napo. You know, she had her school teacher that was working second jobs at Christiana on the weekend because she was only making $47,000 after working for 16 years in the district. I was, like, watching a lot of the things we worked on at Denrec, you know, not make the progress we need to offshore wind, languishing for years. You know, a lot of the reforms that folks were pushing on, you know, criminal justice reform, economic reform, were also kind of languishing. And I consider both Matt and Bethany friends, but it was kind of more of the same. And so that's when I, you know, it's, I think I've become a lot more progressive in my role at the National Wildlife Federation, kind of being on the front line of working on funding for environmental justice and climate and just kind of seeing the intersectionality of these movements. And so, you know, seeing Delaware underperform on so many levels, and I mean, I thought others might jump in. Other more progressive folks may jump into the race and there may be other options that never materialized. And there was kind of different reasons for that. But, you know, when I was talking to, you know, Sophie and Medina and Larry and others that are good friends, you know, trying to figure out, you know, is there enough alignment? And then, you know, Carl and I had breakfast at a Panera a while ago. And he gave me
Panera,
this,
Carl? That's what working families is part of doing, Panera bread?
Well, because the Hollywood Grill closed.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
But so he said, let me send you the questionnaire at the end of it. It was a great, great conversation. But, you know, he sent me the questionnaire, and I got into the questionnaire, and I went really deep into it. I mean, I gave one of my, you know, 50-page responses to a 20-page document. And I realized there was complete alignment of priorities. And I think that it was that combination of things. And also just, you know, kind of doing the research in that process of realizing, look, all these other states, including states that have not even Democratic majorities in some cases, have, you know, already accomplished so much more. That's when I decided that, you know, I would try to, you know, put my name forward and give folks a progressive alternative to two more establishment candidates.
Cool. Well, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it. I was skeptical, still a little skeptical.
But how can I assuage your concern?
I don't think the concern now even comes from like something you can assuage. I just don't know. I mean, telling you this is Delaware is not, you know, going to come as a big surprise to you. The issue is that both Bethany and Matt have sort of established constituencies. And I wonder how that works, like on a strategy side. I don't want you to tell me because I think the microphones are still on.
I can share a little bit,
but I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, if sure. Well, I mean, as much as you would like, when you think about the strategy side, not just sort of the foundational sort of ideals of how you'd like to govern and what you think you can do, knowing how Delaware works the way you do, and, you know, all of that's cool, but just the idea of, you know, not only breaking into the establishment that we've talked about now for an hour or whatever, but also two establishment candidates, really. Almost, I wonder how you thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, for me, if you look at, you know, basic polling, you know, in Delaware right now, no, folks are pretty dissatisfied, right? I mean, like Democrats, right direction, wrong direction kind of questions, you're at like 2/3 to like 80% somewhere in there of folks being like dissatisfied with the direction right now. Now, whether that kind of manifests at the ballot box is kind of an open question, but you go through every issue, right? You look at concerns over affordable housing, concerns over healthcare, concerns over childcare, concerns over education, concerns over jobs and wages and inflation. Like if that gets attached to the incumbent party, as it should, right, there's a massive opening, which is why I think you've seen, you know, multiple public polls at this point that either one of them, you know, kind of crossing 30%. And so you still have this, you know, massive, you know, 40 to 60% that are undecided. And then if you ask the next question about, like, how strong is your support for your preferred candidate, then those numbers erode to almost nothing. And so we're, you know, and again, they're both friends. They've both done innovative things in different places. I mean, I think, you know, Matt's use of some of the federal money has been really creative. I think, you know, Bethany's led on some important issues around overdoses and some of the COVID issues. But I think in terms of, like, a different vision for the state, I'm not sure we'll get, you know, that. And so I think if we can articulate saying, like, this is what it's going to mean on the issues, and then ideally working in tandem with some amazing, you know, Working Families Party candidates to kind of show, hey, here's a team that can deliver a slate of results, that they're not aspirational. They're actually, like, they're deliverable because we actually will have the votes to do it. You know, I mean, if we can have that kind of complicated, kind of complex messaging, it could be, you know, the stars could align as they've had in some other states, right? We've had some of these models where, you know, having an outsider after, you know, years of insiders, you know, is pretty attractive.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I wasn't aware that there was decent polling on sort of like the lay of the land like that. I know, you know, because it's Delaware and we don't really have a media market. And we have an entrenched sort of conservative Democratic Party that runs the state, as you've said. And so, because we don't have really good polling, it's hard to convince anybody to go with an insurgent because they don't. They're like, well, can they win? And I think you made a good case that you probably can if those numbers are to be, you know, if people, if that polling is to be believed in, not even relied on, but just to believe that there is a a tranche of undecideds like that. Yeah, I mean, that's a way to go if that's real.
Well, look, and I think you know, we're in this evolution, right? And I think the challenge I'm facing, and I think, you know, Carl probably sees this when he's working doors and with other candidates, there's a lack of belief that things can get better. Right, there's almost like it's like a desperation right now. Like folks are just like they're just like resigned to the fact they're paying, you know, 35% of their money in housing and, you know, 25% on health. I mean, it's just like, and so how we convince folks to believe, right? But in a real way, but it's like it's not like slogans, right? But like here's an actual like agenda that, like, you know, in the first, you know, 6 months we could actually operationalize. You know, and that's where I get excited about the candidates, because I do think that, you know, because the party system is frayed so much, because there's, you know, there's a lot of like developer money and lobbyist money, but there's not a lot of other, right? There's like, it's not an insurmountable hill that you can actually outwork people if you're on doors, if you're actually working, you know, kind of the grassroots. And to your point around having a movement candidacy, I mean, I think, you know, there's been so much success by WFE the last few years by having, you know, great candidates and then kind of running really stellar campaigns. If you actually marshal those across multiple races, right, all of a sudden, then it gets really interesting to try to, you know, have a movement kind of bolt, you know, get to the point where you have these majorities that affect leadership votes, right? That affect, you know, constitutional amendments, that affect all these things that we're stuck with right now.
I have a lot to think about. I'll be mulling it over, because I think a lot of it has to do with sort of what you said. I mean, Medina articulated it too, and sort of said, like, you know, I just don't know if we can have good, nice things. You know, is this, it feels like this was something that could work, and I kind of feel like that too. I've been in it a little bit, and people have darkened my doorway with, you know, good ideas, and some of them have even, you know, climb the ranks of legislative leadership. And, you know, they just didn't have, they didn't have the goods. They couldn't do it. And so there's something else to it, to be able to do it. I'm not going to say names, Carrie Harris. You can beep that if you want to. Eugene, to some extent, some of the candidates the Working Families Party has gotten elected. And I say gotten elected. You know who you are. So yeah, I'm like gun shy. Like that was I think that was maybe what made me so apprehensive about the endorsement when it came out, because I'm like gun shy, and this is a big sort of, it's a big chance, I think, you know, because we have two establishment candidates, because your record was sort of murky at DenRec with movement, you know, with people who are environmentalists or leftists or movement people. So it was like, do I want to take the leap? So I don't know. I honestly don't know. But it has nothing to do with your ideas, because I think that they're right. You know, we do need somebody in the executive branch who's going to, because this is what I've always said. This has been my, as I said before, this has been my main critique of the Delaware Way and Carney specifically. No agenda, no ideas, no sort of, you know. Now, again, he dealt with COVID, so I gave him a couple marks for that. But he came to the table with nothing. It's a big nothing. And we need someone to spell out for people. I mean, not to make too a fucking meal of it, but the way fucking FDR did it. Spell it out for people. This is what we're doing. I know that it's different. People are mad. That's just tough shit. This is what we're doing. And you know, I'm for that. So, you know, well, I mean, that's what we're talking about.
We basically need like more of an abundance agenda, right? We're basically saying, like, look, we can have nice things because we're going to make these investments. And we've had basically kind of fiscal austerity, you know, kind of British conservative style austerity, right, for a long time here. And it's just, you know, and because of that, we don't get the return on investment. We don't calculate the savings. So all of that is set up wrong. I think where I get excited is that I do think folks are just fed up. Right. I think we're seeing it. We're seeing it in different places and for different reasons. But like the go along to get along just isn't working right now. And if there's a way to, you know, kind of mobilize, and like you said, articulate that first 100 days, first year, and set things on a different path. It's a very different Delaware very quickly because we're not that far away because the legislature, because the work you've all done, right? So it's like it's teed up. It's just a matter of getting across the getting across the goal line.
Yeah, and the tricky part is, you know, again, going back to sort of the strategy, and this is why getting this dumb thing from Carney for mayor is just like provoked me so much. It's just because, like, yeah, what he's saying here in playing the Przycki plan again is that there are affluent white professionals, mostly white professionals, affluent, you know, those type of people, and you know, if you just want to keep the system going the way it is, you're going to have to get with the program and vote for John Carney. Now, that's what you're up against. And this is the kind of bullshit that we're up against. And so, you know, if that's the kind of stuff you're taking on, I'm going to get behind it. Like I said, I don't know what that means. Like I've already gotten in trouble. I don't know if you know this, but I got in a lot of trouble about saying, like, being adamant about not voting and shitting on it and critiquing everybody and all of this. I'm in a lot of trouble with my movement friends because I'm not motivated to get behind anybody again. I think, Carl, do you remember probably the end of last year? I was like, I don't think I'm going to talk to a political candidate ever again in here.
Yeah, you held that up pretty well.
Yeah, I did make exceptions for people I made up. I mean, like Brendan Fletcher, Claire Snyder Hall,
Nick,
yeah, I mean, Matt.
Colin.
So that's a great point, a great way to end this. Bethany, we love you. My wife, as you know, or probably somebody has told you, is a public health nurse. It's her job. It's what she's done for like 35 years. She worked in the emergency room for a long time, but she's a public health nurse. So we like what you're selling. We like, you know, we like your vibe. We like how you talk in the Senate with the gavel and stuff. That's fun. Come in to the thing. Matt's been here. Colin's here right now. Come in, talk about it. Now, I don't want to be ambushing anyone. We're going to have to talk about your audits. There's been audits. And people are they're rightfully skeptical of these inconsistencies. But come in. We'll talk about other stuff, too. You saw Colin came in. I yelled at him about fucking Bloom and shit. He's fine. He's fine. He's not going to do it again, he said. He learned his lesson. Colin, thank you for taking the time. I do really appreciate it, and I know you know you just came from a 2-hour ordeal over at the church on Route 9. So, thanks for coming in and taking the time. I appreciate it.
No, thanks, Robin. Like, thanks for everything you do. Actually, getting folks talking about real stuff.
Yeah, cool. Well, I appreciate it. And look, you know where to reach us, folks. It's Patreon.com/TheHighlandsBunker. Look, most of you are freeloaders. You get all this for free. You're probably listening on iTunes or some other platform. You're like, oh, you can pay for this? Yeah, you can. Patreon.com/TheHighlandsBunker. Help us out. Left is best.